Call this meeting of the Judiciary Finance and Civil Law Committee to order. We are meeting remotely pursuant to Rule 10.01. We will start with the roll. Anna, please go ahead and start with the roll.
Chair Becker Finn.
Present.
Representative Moeller.
Present.
Representative Scott. Representative Feist.
Present.
Representative Frazier.
Present.
Representative Fossil.
Here.
Representative Herr.
Present.
Representative Hollins.
Present.
Representative Johnson. Representative Liebling.
Present.
Representative Long.
Present.
Representative Mortensen.
Present.
Representative Novotny.
Present.
Representative Farr.
Present.
Representative Robbins.
Present.
Representative Vang.
Present.
Representative Zhang.
Present.
Representative Scott.
Present.
And Representative Johnson.
I know before we went live, Representative Johnson may have had the wrong Zoom link. So hopefully we'll get him over here as soon as possible. And you know, just to note, we can't look around the room to see people when they walk in the room. So that's why we call the roll. It's not to try to catch anybody being 1 minute late into the Zoom room. So we have two bills up today, as well as a presentation from tax court. But first, we need to approve the minutes of January 26th. Representative Hollins, do I have a motion to approve the minutes of January 26th?
So moved, Madam Chair.
All right. Thank you, Representative Hollins. Any discussion to the minutes? Seeing none, all those in favor, please say aye.
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 Opposed? All right. The minutes are approved. First, we'll go to the tax court presentation. I will, may need to mute myself more than normal today. I've got, my kids are at home playing Legos and I don't want to interrupt them when they're playing nicely together. So, with that, we will get to the tax court presentation. We have a couple judges here today. I'm not sure who's going first in the presentation. So if you just want to go ahead, and introduce yourselves for the record, when it is your turn to start speaking, we can just get going with the presentation. So please go ahead.
Very good. Chair Becker Finn, committee members, I'm Brad Della Pena, Chief Judge of the Minnesota Tax Court. I appear today with Judges Wendy Tien and Jane Bowman. We appreciate the opportunity to discuss the court's work. I'll begin with some brief institutional context. Minnesota's tax system involves all three branches of government. Legislative bodies create tax policy at the state and local levels, deciding what will be taxed and to what extent. Executive branch officials enforce the law, the commissioner of revenue at the state level, assessors at the local level. Finally, courts review enforcement activity to ensure that taxpayers are treated lawfully. The legislature created the tax court to perform this last function, to serve as a check upon state and local enforcement activities. It's worth noting that taxpayers initiate all of the approximately 3,000 tax court cases filed annually seeking the court's review of executive enforcement. Although the tax court resides in the executive branch rather than the judicial branch, we have true judicial independence. Once appointed by the governor, tax court judges are not subject to removal by the governor. And the tax court reviews final agency action rather than making recommendations to taxing officials before they act, as other administrative courts sometimes do. Consequently, the court is truly independent of tax enforcement officials. The tax court's structural independence allows it to engage in genuine and searching review of all state tax enforcement. Judge Bowman will now brief you more on the court's actual work.
Thank you, Judge De La Pena, and good morning, committee members. My name is Jane Bowman. I am one of the judges on the Minnesota Tax Court, and I am going to share my screen to give you a visual for some of the information that I have. Okay, I'm assuming that everybody can see my screen, which says Minnesota Tax Court overview. I wanted to reiterate a couple points that Judge De La Pena made, that we're an independent executive branch court established by statute, specifically to hear tax-related disputes. We have three judges, all three of us are here today, and all of us have extensive experience in both tax law as well as trial experience. We have three staff members, and we have three law clerks or staff attorneys. So our court is rather small with nine members, but we are all collegial and get along very well, which is very nice. We have, as mentioned previously, approximately 3,000 matters per year, and this is fairly consistent over the years. As you can see, the vast majority of the cases in tax court are property tax appeals, but a lot of the commissioner cases, which Judge Tien is going to talk about, take up more substantial time, even if it's a smaller number. So as Judge De La Pena mentioned, all of the cases are taxpayer initiated. And in the property tax assessment side of the cases, we hear petitions on a wide variety of properties, all the way from residential properties and vacant and raw land to the biggest structures and buildings that we have here, commercial properties and downtown office buildings. Most of the cases challenge the assessed value, arguing that the value was too high. Although we do hear classification objections, as well as claims that property should be exempt from taxation. We hear cases in all 87 counties, and we're looking forward to when it's safe again to travel, because the cases can be heard in the taxpayer's county of residence at their election, or in our tax courtroom in St. Paul. And so with that, I'm going to turn it over to Judge Tien, who is going to talk a little bit about commissioner cases.
Thank you, Judge Bowman, and good morning, Chair Becker-Finn and committee members. Thank you for having me here. I appreciate this opportunity to be before you with my colleagues. As Judge Bowman mentioned, the cases filed against the Commissioner of Revenue, these are appeals from orders of the Commissioner of Revenue, represent a small portion of the tax court's docket, generally about 90 to 140 cases a year, or about 2%. But because they often include the highest dollar value litigation involving the state, they consume a disproportionate amount of the court's time relative to the docket size. I would say about 30% of the court's time. And I would also offer another reason why, you know, people are assessed for property taxes every year, unlike commissioner cases, which usually result from audits of individual income tax or audits of corporate franchise tax or audits of sales tax. Audits, unlike property tax assessments, don't normally happen every single year. And for that reason, they tend to be more contentious and, again, consume a lot more of the court's time. And those issues can range from simple to complex issues. They might involve simple income tax issues. They might involve residency challenges or an audit regarding sales and use taxes or liability for those taxes. They might often involve the taxation of multi-state businesses, corporate franchise tax, or tobacco taxes and that sort of thing. So as you can see, there's a wide range of tax issues, state and local tax issues that come before the Commissioner of Revenue. Judge Bowman, could I ask you to advance the screen, please? Thank you. From the matters that we hear, we prepare written findings of fact, conclusions of law, and in most cases, a supporting memorandum regarding the decided matter. you can see from the below graphic that over the years, our work product has been pretty consistent regarding the number of decisions and substantive orders filed. Decisions, in this case, refers to dispositive matters, summary judgment orders, trial orders, orders on motions to dismiss. We are using the term published orders here to refer to matters that are not on those kinds of decisions, such as decisions on discovery orders and that sort of thing. Decisions in small claims cases are not included here because they are usually unpublished, as are routine procedural orders. I would like to note that you can see from the last 4 years or so that the written output of the court has been very consistent. And I point you to the last year where, even with the arrival of two new judges, it's Judge Bowman and me, and the onset of the pandemic, we have endeavored to maintain same level of work product reflecting the expectations of the bar and our own expectations and the expectations of the public. And I just want to credit the court staff for being really flexible and adapting to the changing needs due to the pandemic. And I also want to thank the bar for being very adaptable and adjusting quickly to our need for remote hearings and the like. Before the pandemic, the court already had a telephonic hearing process for non-evidentiary hearings that we employed from time to time. And that did enable us to transition pretty readily to a telephonic hearing process for more non-evidentiary hearings. And I think that was very helpful. So in any case, I think it was very useful for the bar and the court to cooperate together on that and has enabled us to move our docket forward. Judge Bowman, if I could have the next slide, please. As with all courts, the tax court is very focused on equal access to justice, and our fiscal 2021 initiatives, I think, reflect that as they have in previous years. We are moving forward, as we have previously, with technological initiatives that make the court's docket more accessible. And although we have now an e-docketing system for the court, we are working on providing public web-based, public-facing access to that docketing system, and also in the future implementing e-filing for pleadings and court documents. That is something that we have not fully been able to implement for reasons that we understand are due to technological limitations. But we are working on that, and wrapped into that, when it is technologically feasible, will be the need for amendments to procedural statutes and also to our own administrative rules. Those will allow for e-filing here as well as in the district court. And that's it, I think, for our presentation. Thank you very much.
Thank you all, and thank you for keeping us focused. Really appreciate that. I will note that we did note that Representative Johnson is here today, and this presentation was, we didn't email it out ahead of time, but our committee administrator will be posting it to the website as well as emailing it out to members of the committee. If you're wondering, we'll be able to send that out. And with that, members, are there any questions for our tax court judges? It doesn't look like we have any. I guess we're just really excited to vote on some bills today. As always, I'm sure if members think of questions after the fact, they are welcome to reach out to our tax court judges and their staff to try to get their questions answered. That must have been the best PowerPoint we've had thus far, because you answered a lot of things in your PowerPoint. So thank you very much for joining us today and for sharing a little bit about your work. And with that, we will move on to our one of two bills today from Representative Moeller. The first bill we're going to be hearing is House File 113, which is the Uniform Recognition and Enforcement of Canadian Orders for Protection Act. I just call it the Canadian OFP bill because that's kind of a mouthful. Representative Moeller, would you like to move your bill?
Yes, Madam Chair, I move that House File 113 be recommended to be placed on the General Register.
All right. Thank you so much, Representative Mueller. And with that, why don't you go ahead and tell us about your bill?
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. As the chair mentioned, this is the what we call the Canadian OFP bill. And this bill really is meant to protect survivors of domestic violence, particularly those survivors who have orders for protection in Canada. This bill, and I have some great testifiers, so I'm not going to testify much about it, was a recommendation by the Uniform Law Commission. And as members know, we just heard a presentation about the great work that the commission does. And just to also point out that in Minnesota, we have full faith and credit with other states to recognize other orders for protection filed around the country, and that many or most of Canada at this point recognizes our orders for protection as well. And so with that, I, Madam Chair, would like to turn this over to my testifiers, and I believe Commissioner Timmons is going to speak first.
Commissioner Timmons, please introduce yourself for the record and go ahead with your testimony.
Start my video, see if I can get myself on here. I am Michelle Timmons, former reviser of statutes and now a Uniform Law Commissioner, which I've been for 22 years. And I'd like to talk to you just a little bit about House File 113. Essentially, what this does is it expands to Canada what we already do for domestic violence protection orders from other states, and that is enforce them. It would expand our reciprocity to Canada. This Uniform Act was approved by the Uniform Law Commission in 2015, and it's a collaboration between the Uniform Law Commission and the Uniform Law Conference of Canada. It was worked out during the time that Judge Harriet Lansing was president of the Uniform Law Commission. And the Canadian provinces of Manitoba, Saskatchewan, British Columbia, and Quebec already recognized and enforced Minnesota orders for protection. So I think that this act has the potential to reduce violence in Minnesota with minimal cost. It also, if the pandemic ends here soon, we hope it could assist with business travel and promote tourism. Minnesota is one of the most often visited states by Canadians in normal times. And I want to say that I got on the legislative website this morning and was pleased to see that this bill will be introduced in the Senate today as Senate File 395 by Senator Johnson. And there are a number of co-authors, Senators Bach, Utke, Eichhorn, and Matthews. It's been referred to the Civil Law and Data Practices Policy Committee in the Senate. So there is a Senate companion, yay. And I should say also that this act has been enacted in six other states, including our neighboring states of North Dakota and Wisconsin, as well as Washington State, California, Nevada, and Delaware. Members of this committee may recall that this act was introduced in Minnesota last session as House File 3603, and Representative Mueller carried it last year as well. But unfortunately, we testified, I think it was March 12th on this act, and a day or two later, everything was shut down due to the pandemic. So the bill was not heard in the Senate and was not enacted last year. So we are here again, including a number of stakeholder supporters. And I guess I'd like to turn it over to supporters for additional testimony at this time.
All right, thank you, Ms. Timmons. Next on the list, we have Judge Lansing. If you wanna go ahead with, introduce yourself and go ahead with your testimony.
Good morning. I think I'm off mute. Can you hear me, Chair?
Terrific. Yeah, we're good. Please go ahead.
All right. I'm Harriet Lansing. I'm a retired judge of the Minnesota Court of Appeals, and I am a life member of the Uniform Law Commission. And I'll give you just a little bit of background of our work with Canada. We've had a very close working relationship, the Uniform Law Commission itself, as well as Minnesota being a neighboring state. And we have had a number of collaborative acts that we've worked on. In fact, the Canadian Uniform Law Commission is patterned after the United States Commission. They recently celebrated their 100-year anniversary. We, having been created in 1892, have about 25 years on them, but we have helped them come along, and they're doing very well. We've worked with them on a variety of issues, charitable organizations, child support enforcement, most recently substitute decision making, which is healthcare directives, Canadian money judgments, and registration of those orders. So this is one that we are very interested in having passed, because we think it represents an opportunity for more safe interaction, and has the benefit of providing protection where it is needed. I'm happy to answer questions, but at this point, this is the information that I have, and I know we have two individuals who are going to provide additional testimony who work directly in the area of enforcement of protective orders and individuals who need them. So I will defer to them, and I will await any of your questions.
Right. Thank you, Judge Lansing. And we do have two other people signed up to testify, so we're going to get through the testimony, and then we will go to member questions. Next on the list is Cheryl Thomas. Ms. Thomas, if you want to unmute yourself and introduce yourself for the record, and then go ahead.
Well, thank you to the chair, and thank you to all of you, and a special thanks to Representative Kelly Moeller. I am Cheryl Thomas, and I am the executive director of a Minneapolis-based organization, Global Rights for Women. And our organization does legal and systemic change work around the world to address violence against women. And many of you may know that the most common form of violence against women in the world is domestic violence. So that's what is addressed, of course, by the Order for Protection. And from our work around the world, we know that the Order for Protection, certainly here in the United States and in other countries, has been really one of the most effective, if not the most effective, remedy that victim survivors have to address the brutal violence that women are facing all over the world. The need for cross-border collaboration has been just really clearly stated by numerous global leaders, and certainly United Nations Women's Agencies that Global Rights for Women often works for has stressed this need for the kind of thing that we've done here in the United States, the full faith and credit, where victims of violence can move around and also still be protected from their abusers by the Order for Protection. I'll just say a little bit about the extent of domestic violence globally is alarming. The recent United Nations Office for Drugs and Crime report has statistics that we haven't had really in the last 20 years, 30 years that I've been working in this field. 137 women per day are killed by family members intimate partners, mostly men throughout the world. So that is just really a statistic that policymakers we just really hope that policymakers will increasingly pay attention to that statistic, 137 women per day. That's over 50,000 women per year globally are killed in domestic violence incidents. So I just give you those statistics, and they're in the handout I provided to give a sense of just the serious nature of this problem globally. Minnesota has been an incredible leader on this issue for decades. We opened the first shelter in the world back in 1970s. The Duluth model of coordinated community response is being replicated around the world. And the power and control wheel, some of you may be familiar with, resonates with people across the globe. And we are looked to, I say that just to emphasize how Minnesota is looked to for progressive leadership on addressing the global pandemic of violence against women, and in particular domestic violence. So I think this House File 113 is a wonderful step forward in addressing this global pandemic. It allows, you know, women who are coming across the border to have their orders of protection enforced here in Minnesota. Just a really important step for us as a state and as a leader in the country. And I hope it goes forward, actually, in other ways. I hope it's just a tool that more and more states and countries use to ensure that when there's been violence perpetrated against a victim, that it won't be the border that stops her from accessing remedies that she needs. So with that, I too am happy to answer questions, and thank you again for this opportunity to testify.
Thank you very much, Ms. Thomas. And the last testifier I have on my list is Katie Kramer. Katie, if you could introduce yourself for the record and go ahead with your testimony.
Good morning, Chair Becker-Finn, members of the committee. I'm Katie Kramer, Policy Director of Violence-Free Minnesota, the Coalition to End Relationship Abuse. We are a statewide coalition with over 90 member programs who provide advocacy and services to domestic and sexual violence victim survivors in all of Minnesota's 87 counties. I'm testifying today in support of HF 113, permitting Minnesota to recognize Canadian orders for protection. Victim survivors who come to Minnesota from Canada to travel, work, attend school, visit family, or relocate for their safety or for any other reason should expect that their protection orders will be enforced in all jurisdictions on either side of the border. An example of this need is a woman from a Canadian reserve who had a Canadian protective order. She came to Brainerd, Minnesota, and her abuser followed suit. Out of fear for her safety, she ended up in a domestic violence shelter. Because she came from the reserve, she was able to cross the border with just her tribal ID. But in order to get an order for protection for the woman in Minnesota, the shelter had to secure additional identification from Canada and then get a Minnesota protective order, resulting in delays, risks to her safety, and the experience of additional trauma. Had this law been in place, it would have streamlined this process for this victim. The woman in this example was fortunate in that she was connected with an advocacy program that could help her navigate matters. For a victim who is in Minnesota with a Canadian protective order, whose perpetrator follows her, who is afraid for her safety, that victim should be able to call law enforcement directly without a concern that Minnesota won't recognize Canadian orders for protection. Full faith and credit, when a court in any jurisdiction will honor and enforce orders issued by courts in other jurisdictions, is not a new concept. The Federal Violence Against Women Act, or VAWA, enacted in 1994, gave protection orders the benefit of interjurisdictional enforcement through its full faith and credit provision, so that valid orders of protection may be enforced where it is issued and in all 50 states, tribal lands, the District of Columbia, and U.S. territories. Alice Full Faith and Credit provision protects survivors' freedom of movement by requiring law enforcement and the courts to enforce protective orders throughout the country. We believe this legislation will help ensure survivor safety and offender accountability on either side of the border. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Kramer. That is all that I have on my list for testifiers. And so I thank you all for sticking around. We will get to questions now from members. Representative Johnson.
Chair, members, I am much in favor of this type of situation, but I do have some concerns. One concern I have is how an officer gets a physical copy of this if the victim doesn't have the order with them. As an officer, we would get reports of violations of order for protections, but before we could do an arrest or anything like that, we actually had to see a copy of that order because we had to read it. We had to make sure that there wasn't something in that order or that something in the order was actually violated. And I'm just wondering how we're gonna be able to obtain, the officers are gonna be able to obtain that copy from another jurisdiction. It's one thing inside the United States, but when you start talking in international, how are we gonna be able to, because we don't have the information, even email, or a lot of times we don't have a phone call, a number to actually call that department where that order is issued in another country. So how are we going to handle that? That's what I'm wondering, because the officer actually has to have a copy of that order, whether it's email, and they have to be able to verify that it's an actual order and is in place at that time. I'm not sure which one of the testifiers could answer that.
I'll actually go to Representative Moeller first, and then we'll see. I'm pretty sure she'll be able to answer this question. So go ahead, Representative Moeller.
Yeah, thanks, Madam Chair, and thanks, Representative Johnson, for your question. So a couple of different ways that this can happen here. The victim doesn't need to have a certified copy of an order for protection. The victim may actually have a paper copy of the order for protection. Ultimately, that isn't required either. And one other thing, the victim can also, under this bill, register their Canadian order for protection in Minnesota. And those will be available to the BCA and will be available for law enforcement officers to read. So some victims can do that. Others may have copies. Others may be able to access electronically a copy of their Canadian order for protection. And beyond that, it's a probable cause determination by law enforcement. And as you know, Representative Johnson, from your years in law enforcement, officers make probable cause determinations all the time, whether that's for an arrest, whether that's for a search, whether that's for a complaint. And so officers will be using lots of different information to try to determine if there's probable cause. One other thing, importantly, officers are provided with immunity if they act in good faith. And that's a really important provision that I want to make sure folks are aware of. That's it, Madam Chair. Thanks.
Thank you, Representative Moeller. Follow-up, Representative Johnson.
Yes, I do have some follow on that, and I also have another question as well. The officer still needs to verify. The county attorneys require that that it is verified. Otherwise, you can actually end up with a false arrest situation. You had in there about the good faith and that stuff, and officer, which is the officer immunity clause. In public safety last year and in this year, I believe there's a push to get rid of that immunity, even at the federal level. So that even makes me more concerned on this bill, because the officers do their best to act in good faith. And like I say, if there's an order, we want to enforce it. But we do have to verify that the order exists. The one way is to bring that order from Canada down and register it, and before it's actually put in the system, it is verified that it is a good order. But somebody just handing a paper copy, we still, even here, if somebody comes from a different state and they hand us their paper copy, before we can do anything, we have to notify and talk to that jurisdiction to make sure it's in effect and it is a still active order. That's my concerns with that. The other issue I have, I know there's six states that have this. The last testifier talked about that federal law where we order honor things with between different states, U.S. properties or territories and stuff like that. But that's U.S. law. I have concerns doing this international law. Does the state have the authority to enforce international law? I don't think that's ever been tested in courts. I have concerns because now we're dealing with a police officer or a law enforcement officer in Minnesota enforcing a international law. And I don't think they have the authority to do that, even if we pass a law. So I want to make sure we do this, we do it right, and we do it proper to make sure. But I do want to make sure that those victims of domestic abuse are safe. I like the idea of being able to bring that down and registering it in the state of Minnesota because it can be verified. We have access to it. I think that is the route to go, that they would have to bring that order in and get it certified here. But just enforcing another country's law that has not made any oath to the office in the United States, and their laws are different as well. Does the requirements to get a restraining order same as the basic ones in the United States? Does the offender have an opportunity to appeal, or can they just go get one? So if we're going to grant the rights of the victims, we also have to make sure that the constitutional rights of the subject is also valid. But like I say, I want to do whatever we can to protect these women. And believe it or not, there's also men that have restraining orders against their wives, against the female domestic violator. But I want to make sure whoever the victim is protected, but we want to make sure we do it in the proper way.
Response, Representative Moeller.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Representative Johnson, for that. I'm going to take a couple of those comments, and then I'm going to turn it over to my testifiers for some of the other ones. Just to make a distinction here, too, between when an order for protection is violated versus when we're in court trying to prove beyond a reasonable doubt that there's a crime, that there's an order for protection violation. What we're talking about here is just the initial situation where the victim has an order for protection and has a concern, has a violation and calls, and that's the probable cause determination. So just want to make that distinction between the probable cause determination at this point versus proving a crime later on, which still requires a beyond a reasonable doubt standard. As far as registration here, I think that if this bill passes, and this is something that I confirmed with Ms. Kramer, that they will be training their advocates and talking to their law enforcement partners around the state, particularly those in northern Minnesota who might have more visitors from Canada coming in, to try to encourage victims to register their Canadian orders for protection here. However, I don't think just requiring registration is enough. You might have a victim who's just traveling here for 1 week as opposed to someone who's regularly visiting family or perhaps working here in some capacity. And so being able to still protect those victims who are here temporarily and maybe didn't, even know about the registration here, if there is a violation, being able to call and get that protection from law enforcement is really essential. I would also like to turn it over to my testifiers about your concern about international law enforcement. And I see that Judge Lansing perhaps is ready to speak to some of this as well.
Judge Lansing, please go ahead. And in normal times, somebody would walk up to the table and I would know that that was the right person to answer the question. But good job raising your hand. Judge Lansing, go ahead.
Great. Thank you, Chair Becker-Finn. I'm trying to get used to these Zoom methodologies. And we appreciate the questions, Representative Johnson, because we want to make this absolutely workable and not to have flaws, or problems that we'll encounter down the line. But in terms of enforceability, validity, constitutionality, you should rest assured that this is, as I mean, I don't have specific cases before me, but I could get some, we can get some for you. But we have, for instance, the Family Support Act, the International Family Support Act, in which we have been working with Canada for years and now with other countries as well. So that act is enforced in the same way that the provisions within the Minnesota statute are enforced. And that's that's what is provided for in this act. Also, in terms of getting the information about whether or not there is a protection order that has been issued, the Canadian provinces have a very sophisticated methodology on availability of the protection orders. I checked this morning and in British Columbia, because that is the province that has been used as most commonly as the model. And they have there's a central number and it can be accessed 24 hours a day to get confirmation and up-to-date information about the issuance of the order and the validity of the order and that it is still in effect. And that's accessible, and every order, when it is issued by a court, is entered into this registry. So they have an automatic registration process. So I hope that that will answer some of your questions. Thank you very much.
Yeah, thank you, Judge Lansing. Last follow-up, Representative Johnson, please go ahead.
Chair, I appreciate the answers, but they brought up brings up another question on that Support Act. Is that a federal law, a federal treaty amongst the states? Because law enforcement cannot enforce federal law. Local law enforcement, it's got to be a federal agent that takes care, that is involved in that. I believe that act is a federal treaty with the federal government amongst other countries. And there again, it doesn't apply to the state of Minnesota because it's a federal law.
Judge Lansing.
Chair Becker Finn and Representative Johnson, I'm glad you asked me that question because I worked on the enactment of the Family Interstate Support Act with the legislature several years ago. And you are absolutely right. It did originate with a multilateral treaty among a number of countries. And it did have the support of the federal government that required that it be enacted in order for states to receive child support funds. But it comes down to a state statute. And every state enacted this statute that was drafted by the Uniform Law Commission. We went through a number of drafts. So all the language came from the Uniform Law Commission's drafting committee, was then enacted in every state, including Minnesota, and that was used as the ratification for the international treaty, so at the Hague Convention. So I hope that answers your question.
All right, thank you, Judge Lansing. And I will note, I do want to make sure, this is, I think, important for the record. There was mentioned before about what county attorneys will think of something. And I think the important thing to remember with an order for protection is that, charging somebody with a crime and convicting somebody of something for violating the order for protection is not actually the main point of having an order for protection. It's giving the victim the ability to have a tool, if they choose to use it, that can help keep them safe in their day-to-day lives. So I just want to make sure that we're not sort of losing sight of the fact that that is the end goal. Not seeing any other Representative Johnson, one more comment and then we're going to move on.
Like I said, I do want to see something like this go through. but I do have some concerns about being able to enforce another country's laws without a, as the last testifier mentioned, that they worked up a treaty, an international treaty that allowed the states to do this. I don't think we have that. I'm going to vote for this because I think it's a good idea because there's some things in there I think can work. But I do have a lot of concerns that I think they need to work and get and do like they did on the Support Act, get a treaty set up with multi-jurisdiction or multiple counties at the federal level that allows the states to do this. Because I think we're these states that are doing this might be overstepping their bounds, and they could that if it's challenged, they could, the states could lose big time, and the officer involved could lose very big time.
Representative Mueller, we did not have any amendments filed to this bill. Any closing comments?
You're correct, Madam Chair. No amendments, and just wanted to highlight what you said too. This is really just a tool to keep victims safe. And, you know, Wisconsin and North Dakota are doing this, and we border with Canada, so it's time for us to step up and do this as well, and appreciate your support, members. Thank you.
Yeah, I know if you're going by land, there's even some parts of our state that you can't access without going through Canada. So never want to forget that part of Minnesota. And with that, Representative Mueller, would you like to renew your motion?
Yes, Madam Chair, I'll renew my motion that House File 113 be placed on the General Register.
All right, and with that, the clerk will take the roll.
Chair Becker Finn.
Aye.
Representative Mueller.
Aye.
Representative Scott.
Aye.
Representative Feist.
Aye.
Representative Frazier.
Aye.
Representative Grossel.
Aye.
Representative Herr.
Aye.
Representative Hollins.
Aye.
Representative Johnson.
Aye.
Representative Liebling.
Aye.
Representative Long.
Aye.
Representative Mortensen.
Aye.
Representative Novotny.
Aye.
Representative Farr.
Aye.
Representative Robbins.
Aye.
Representative Vang.
Aye.
Representative Zhang.
Aye.
And with that, Anna, if you could, I didn't count the numbers, Anna, if you could let me know the number of ayes there.
17 ayes.
Okay. With 17 ayes and zero nays, the motion prevails, and House File 113 is on its way to the General Register. So thank you to our testifiers, and with that, we will move on to the next bill on our agenda today, House File 114. Representative Mueller, we get to hear more from you. This is our last bill of the day regarding suspending expiration of statutory deadlines. Representative Mueller, would you like to move your bill?
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. I would move that House File 114 be recommended to be placed on the General Register.
Right. Thank you, Representative Mueller, Vice Chair Mueller. We now have the bill before us. I believe there is an author's amendment to get the bill in the shape that you would like. Would you like to move the A1 amendment?
So moved, Madam Chair.
All right. The amendment we can do on a voice vote. So any discussion to the amendment? All those in favor, please say aye.
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 Aye. Aye. Aye.
Opposed? All right. The amendment is adopted. Representative Mueller, please go ahead with telling us about your bill as amended.
Thanks, Madam Chair and members. So during the 2020 session after the pandemic started, we passed a law that suspended court-related deadlines, and these are deadlines that are set out in statute. The suspension is set to sunset on February 15th. Unfortunately, that the language we enacted regarding this said the running of deadlines, and it's caused some confusion among practitioners. And I do have a testifier who can explain more fully what that confusion is. And perhaps, Madam Chair, I will turn it over to Mr. Lake, I believe, is going to testify first to explain that confusion and the need for this bill.
All right, Mr. Lake, if you could identify yourself for the record and go ahead with your testimony.
Well,
Thank you, Madam Chair. Brian Lake, I'm representing the Minnesota State Bar Association. If any members are unaware, the MSBA is a voluntary professional organization with attorneys in all practice areas in all parts of the state. As Representative Mueller mentioned, this kind of had to be hastily put together and implemented in the early days of the pandemic to ensure the courts could meet their obligations. And I want to say that I think Chief Justice Gilday and the entire judicial branch have done a phenomenal job of completely revamping their operations and managing things during the pandemic so that Minnesotans can still access the courts and seek justice and resolve their disputes. I think there's a little bit of confusion with the law, and I would ask you to concentrate on one word in the current law, and that word is running. The law suspends the running of deadlines. Now, the problem is there are two different ways that people refer to a statute of limitations running. And the first way would be that the clock is ticking. So, there's 30 days left in the statute of limitations, and tomorrow there's going to be 29 days left and so forth. Now, the clock is running on it. The other way that people use the term is to say that a statute of limitations has run, meaning it has expired, it's over. And it's not clear in the law which one of those two interpretations is correct. Therefore, when the suspension period ends on February 15th, there's going to be a lot of uncertainty regarding whether certain deadlines have expired and regarding when some future deadlines are going to expire. So this causes a lot of uncertainty and confusion, and it is particularly problematic in the real estate world. If there's not certainty for real estate related limitations periods, it becomes very difficult or even impossible to clear title and make property marketable. So this is a particular concern for groups in that area as well, and the bill is supported by the Realtors Association, Land Title Association, and others. So Madam Chair, real quickly, I just wanted to talk about the two interpretations, why we are not recommending the ticking clock interpretation and why we are recommending the expiration interpretation. So if the ticking clock interpretation is applied to the law, then however many days were left in a limitations period at the beginning of the peacetime emergency are still going to be left at the end of the suspension period. So let's say that you have a statute of limitations that is scheduled to expire coming up on June 1st. Under that interpretation, you'd have to add 330 days or whatever it's going to be to the end of that. Now, it's a bit of a pain to do that, but where it really gets problematic is there's some, more distant expiration dates. You could have a six-year statute of limitations that's not going to expire for several more years. Everyone's going to have to remember to add the 330 days to that, and then it gets really problematic in certain real estate limitations periods that can last for 30 or 40 years. So decades into the future, everyone's going to have to remember to add 330 days to all these limitations periods. So it's really problematic to do that interpretation. What we are recommending is to do the other interpretation of the law, which is to specify that the law only prevents the expiration of deadlines during the suspension period. This is a, we think, cleaner and simpler interpretation. It still allows, I think, the real intent of the law to be achieved, which was to save the courts from having to be strictly obligated to some deadline periods during the suspension period. I think this has been really well vetted. This is something we've been working on since last summer, well vetted within the bar and outside of the bar with any interested group we could think of. I have not heard from anybody with any concerns. And our goal here is just to clarify the law. It's a pretty simple bill, but I think it'll prevent a lot of confusion and headaches going forward. And Madam Chair, before we get to questions, I just wanted to thank Representative Mueller for her leadership on this. I also want to thank Mr. Johnson with House Research for his drafting assistance, helping clean up the amendment. And for newer members who maybe don't know, House Research attorneys are your friends. They're really, really good and really helpful. And then finally, Madam Chair, I got to thank Ms. Ganani for her patience and listening to me pester her about this endlessly. And I'm sure she's sick of hearing from me, but she has not shown any frustration yet. I really appreciate her. So with that, I'm happy to take any questions that members might have.
Right. Thank you, Mr. Lake. And I will say any annoyance that anyone may have with you, I'm sure as we get closer to February 15th would only increase if we don't deal with this issue. Before we go to questions, I do have one more testifier on the list and I want to get to him first and then we can go to member questions. So if you could stick around, Mr. Lake, we will I will see. Maybe we'll have lots of questions for you. So next we have, I believe, is it Kevin Dunleavy? Please introduce yourself, pronounce your name correctly, and go ahead with your testimony.
Madam Chair, my name is Kevin Dunleavy, and I am the co-chair of the Legislative Committee of the Real Property Section, and I work with Brian Lake quite a bit in the last 3 years. And he did a really good job of summarizing the technical issues with the statutes of limitation. Unfortunately, I just thought of this morning, I could screen share a document that shows a list of the statutes that are affected negatively like this, the 30 year, the 40 year, there's some 10 years, there's some 6 years and 5 years, and there's at least a dozen or two real estate statutes of limitation that are affected by this. And we don't wanna have to add this limitation tolling period to the statutes 30 and 40 years from now. I don't know that I'll still be practicing law then, but I don't want that to fall on my successors. As far as practical things, some of the practical things that are hurt right now because of this are title registration. So that's if you have a title problem or if you have a expensive commercial property, you may want to register it under the TORN system. About half of the metro, the core counties are Torrens, and the next ring of counties, there's a lot of Torrens. Anoka has a lot of Torrens, Dakota, St. Louis County has a lot of Torrens property. And so any new title registration is held up because of this. Lots of ordinary real estate transactions are on hold because title companies can't rely on a lot of these statutes of limitations that I mentioned to cure title problems. So that means houses are sitting vacant or people are unable to move until the statutes of limitations expire. Judicial foreclosures of mortgages are also stalled because the redemption periods are told. That mostly affects commercial property. And contract for deed cancellations and purchase agreement cancellations may not be effective because the actions by the vendee to oppose cancellation may be subject to this tolling as well. Foreclosures by advertisement, which is non-judicial foreclosures, the title problems with those are generally cured by a one-year curative act. And if that statute is told, that means all of those title problems are still out there. The vast majority of residential mortgage foreclosures are by advertisement, probably 95% or so. So the curative act tolling means that there's a significant percentage of foreclosed single family residences that may be vacant, unmarketable, and subject to vandalism. We're not talking about the owner occupied mortgage foreclosures. Those are subject to the tolling, residential eviction moratorium. So we're talking about unoccupied single family dwellings that are unmarketable right now because of this. So anyway, those are some of the problem areas that are being affected by this statute.
Thank you for your testimony. I don't have any other testifiers on the list. Members, do we have any questions? I know that kind of got into some next level property law nerd level discussion, but that's what this committee is here for. Any questions, members? All right, well, not seeing any. Representative Moeller, any closing comments?
Thanks, Madam Chair. Yeah, and just to point out the problem with the sort of tolling, if we did that route and didn't fix this 40 years later, we also, the bill in 2020 was part of a session law. So even for folks to be able to go back and find that will be quite difficult. So thank you so much to Mr. Lake and Mr. Dunleavy for your testimony. And Madam Chair, I would renew my motion that House File 114 be placed on the general register.
And I will clarify that motion is 114 as amended. be placed on the general register. And with that, we will go to the roll. So Anna, please go ahead.
Chair Becker Finn.
Aye.
Representative Mueller.
Aye.
Representative Scott.
Aye.
Representative Feist.
Aye.
Representative Frazier.
Aye.
Representative Grossel.
Aye.
Representative Herr.
Aye.
Representative Hollins.
Aye.
Representative Johnson.
Aye.
Representative Liebling.
Aye.
Representative Long.
Aye.
Representative Mortensen.
Aye.
Representative Novotny.
Aye.
Representative Farr.
Aye.
Representative Robbins.
Aye.
Representative Vang.
Aye.
Representative Zhang.
Aye.
Perfect. We have 17 ayes and 0 nays.
All right. With that, the motion prevails and 114 as amended is on its way to the general register. Thank you, members. I do. We're going to end early today. You get a little bit of your day back. I do want to just remind folks that the Law School for Legislators is tomorrow and then next Friday. Tomorrow on the agenda is updates from Chief Justice Gilday, employment law regarding workplace sexual harassment, legislation in the courts, as well as a housing law update. So if folks are interested in that, just want to make sure that members and staff are aware of that. We will send out the schedule for next week. We will have some bills on the agenda next week. We're waiting to see what else comes our way officially with session today, and then we'll go from there. So thank you, everybody. Thank you to our testifiers and Representative Mueller, as well as our presenters for being efficient with their time today. Certainly is appreciated. So with that, we are adjourned.